Welcome to episode 64. This episode is entitled Janet Malcolm and the Black Art of Biography. My comments are triggered, of course, by her recent death and the tributes to her from many quarters. She was a very provocative writer, very elegant writer in many ways. Perhaps her most famous book is The Silent Woman, her study of Plath biography. One thing I want to say at the outset, which I don't really say in so many words, I don't think in the other comments I'm going to read to you, because I reviewed her book, The Silent Woman, and then I refer to it again in a couple of other books which I'll be reading from. What I don't quite say is, and I think it's important for assessing her own view of biography, she never wrote a biography. Certainly, her work is biographical in nature, but she never did the hard work of biography, by which I mean spending several years interviewing people, if the subject is contemporary or modern, and there are people to interview. The kind of archival work you need to do, often in many archives, and what she never really confronted, and I'm going to confront it actually in my next podcast, episode 65, which is going to be titled Biography in the Hermeneutic Circle. Sounds very academic, but I don't think you'll find it that hard to follow. She never really looked at or thought about, as far as I can see, the hermeneutics of biography, which are quite similar to the hermeneutics of history. That is, how we interpret the past, which has always been fascinating for me, beginning at the age of 18 when I first read William Faulkner and certain historiographers like Wilhelm Dilthey and Rudolf Bultmann, to name two, and R.G. Collingwood, especially my main influence. But I'll get back to that in the next episode. Does one have to be a biographer to write about biography? Obviously not, or to write about history. Or to write reviews of novels, which I have. I've never written a novel. But I do think it makes a difference when one is a biographer. I've talked with many biographers about this subject and how they read biography, and many of them do what I do, which is not start reading the narrative of the biography, but to look at the biography's provenance. And what we do, some of us anyway, as biographers, when we're reading someone else's biography, is we look at the notes, we look at the acknowledgments. In other words, we look at the apparatus. We look at who the biographer talked to or under what auspices this biography is being published and who is publishing it. And the cultural climate in which it's published are all important matters, some of which Malcolm touches on, but not with the kind of, I guess I would call it inside knowledge that a biographer has. Now, when I reviewed The Silent Woman, the book was first published in 1994, I had written five biographies, a biography of Marilyn Monroe, another of Lillian Hellman, one of Martha Gellhorn, Norman Mailer, another subject, and Rebecca West, all of which required extensive archival work and interviewing. So that you should keep in mind. Who is doing the talking? From what point of view do they come is important. And so I was looking at Malcolm's book, and at this point, by the way, I had no idea that I would ever write a biography, let alone two or more biographies of Sylvia Plath. I'm engaged on a third, what I might call a documentary biography, Sylvia Plath Day by Day, and a fourth one, which is going to be called The Making of Sylvia Plath, which has a lot more emphasis on her early years and why they're so crucial in understanding who she is, who she was, and what she became. So here's my review in 1994 of The Silent Woman. This provocative inquiry into the controversial life of the American poet Sylvia Plath and her husband, the English poet Ted Hughes, also probes the nature of biography and attacks contemporary biographers. Janet Malcolm's sympathies lie with the subjects of biography and with their families who must withstand the prying of biographers. She investigates Sylvia Plath's life in order to understand why it has occasioned so many biographies that tend to idealize her and demonize her husband, Ted Hughes, a brilliant English poet and a ruggedly handsome man whom Malcolm believes biographers have maligned. Malcolm calls biographers professional burglars, voyeurs, and busybodies, rifling through the most intimate places in their subjects' lives. This crude delving into gossip is masked by the elaborate apparatus of notes and other documentation, which makes biography appear to be a legitimate enterprise. Malcolm attributes the great popularity of biography to a collusion between biographers and readers, both slavering to read other people's mail and to discover the secrets of other people's lives. Biographies raise the same sort of ethical concerns Malcolm has identified in her book on journalism, The Journalist and the Murderer. The biographer, like the journalist, is driven by repertorial desire, the urge to get a story no matter how it may affect its subjects, their friends, and their families. Like the journalist, the biographer uses the interview to con people into spilling the beans, as she puts it. To her credit, Malcolm does not absent herself from criticism. Once she decides to do a book on the Sylvia Plath phenomenon, she realizes she classes herself with other biographers rooting around for information. Owen Hughes, who has been the bane of every Plath biographer, she too has to deal with the Hughes estate, chiefly Ted's sister Owen, who has been the bane of every Plath biography. But the difference in Malcolm's case is that she is not writing a full-dress biography of Sylvia Plath. She is studying the whole literature of biography that has grown up around this intriguing poet. Plath died a suicide in 1963 by gassing herself in an oven. She had attempted suicide once before as a teenager, and as one of Malcolm's informants tells her, the poet was always a borderline personality, someone on the edge of doing herself in. I would object to that, but that's another story. Plath wrote poetry about suicide and attracted the attention of other poets, such as Anne Sexton, who also committed suicide. Malcolm suggests that certain key elements and texts ensured Plath's canonization as poet and feminist martyr. First, she wrote her best poetry, collected in her book Ariel, in the last year of her life. Until then, she worked in the shadow of her husband, who later became the Poet Laureate of England, and whose collections of poetry won major awards, while Plath struggled to place her poems in magazines and publish them in book form. Her last poetry is vivid and sometimes extremely painful. Its highly personal tone and its use of historical metaphors, such as her allusions to the Holocaust, have attracted both intense praise and condemnation. Virtually no critic, however, denies that her final poems demonstrate genius. Naturally, biographers would want to know why such a brilliant woman killed herself. But in 1963, the year of her death, there was no woman's movement, and Plath's work was not yet well known. What turned the corner in Plath biography, so to speak, was a brilliant memoir by Alvarez, a British poet and critic, writing for a British paper, The Independent. As its poetry editor, Alvarez had published some of Plath's poems and was one of the first to recognize their startling power and originality. He had attempted suicide himself, and he had known Plath in her last years in London, so his prose had a special authority, which reached a general audience when he included his memoir of Plath in his acclaimed book, Suicide, frequently reprinted in paperback. Alvarez revealed for the first time some key details of Plath's biography. Her growing mastery as a poet, her estrangement from her husband Ted Hughes, and her acute suffering during her last days in a bitterly cold England, trying to take care of her two children and getting up at 5 in the morning to write her poetry. Alvarez, a friend of Hughes's as well, was discreet and did not mention many of the details of the Hughes's married life. But as Malcolm shrewdly points out, the very omission of material on Hughes in Alvarez's memoir raised suspicions. What was Ted Hughes's role in Sylvia Plath's death? Ted Hughes himself was quick to see the damage Alvarez had done, but he couched his objections to Alvarez in the form of concern for Sylvia's young children and the pain that Alvarez's speculations would cause them when they were old enough to read them. Alvarez replied that he had created Plath's life with considerable tact, reserve, and sensitivity. Malcolm does not disagree, but she persuasively demonstrates that once Alvarez articulated a vision of Plath's life and death, he opened the door wide to every sort of biographical speculation, exactly what Ted Hughes feared and exactly what has come to pass. Much of The Silent Woman concerns the efforts of Ted and Owen Hughes to keep the lid on Sylvia's life, to discourage and even censor unlicensed biographical interpretation. Malcolm sympathizes with them, feeling they have a right to protect their privacy, especially when it is violated by biographers looking to make a buck or to get an academic promotion or to punish Ted Hughes for a supposedly vile treatment of Sylvia Plath. For Hughes has become the villain of the story. Tales of his violence and womanizing darken the Plath biographical myth. His own poetry is violent, and it is easy to see him as a modern-day Heathcliff. He even hails from Yorkshire, Bronte country, the world of Emily Bronte's Wuthering Heights. Although Ted Hughes opposed the Plath biographers because he said he wanted to protect the privacy of himself and his family, several biographers have suggested he was merely attempting to stifle or even destroy the evidence that placed him in a bad light. Hughes has contributed to this image of himself by destroying one of Plath's journals and claiming another has been lost. His sister Olin, even in Malcolm's sympathetic portrayal of her and her position as literary executor, has harried biographers, even Plath's own authorized biographer Ann Stevenson, whose biography was lambasted by many critics as a put-up job from the Plath estate. How can Malcolm be so sympathetic to Ted and Owen Hughes, especially when Malcolm honestly admits there are many faults and mistakes in the treatment of Plath biographers? Because Malcolm sees biography as an epistemologically problematic genre. That's what I'm going to get at in the next podcast, what I mean by the hermeneutic circle. Malcolm doubts that the biographer can know the truth about much of anything. She raises all sorts of problems with the so-called data biographers collect. Interviews, for example, are done after the subject's death, or at the very least, after the events that the biographer seeks to study. Memories fade and contradict each other. Witnesses to the events have their own agendas. There is no infallible way to tell the truth. Similarly, letters are unreliable. They seem to fix experience, but they are only expressions of the moment and cannot be taken for the subject's final or complete attitudes. Malcolm seeks to strengthen her point by noting that biographers often overstate and dramatize. Her particular target is Paul Alexander, who reconstructs scenes from Plath's life with an immediacy and detail that cannot be verified. Even if some of his details can be traced to letters, interviews, journals, and memoirs, those details are the product of individuals with their own biases. Alexander misleads readers, Malcolm argues, by presenting a story as if it could be objectively told, when the whole mass of it actually is a collection of subjective accounts. Again, I take issue with that, not today, but next week when I talk about the hermeneutic circle. Of course, Malcolm is right about Alexandra's sources, but her conclusions are curiously naive. If she knows that Alexandra's book is skewed, she must have an idea of how to unskew it. In fact, that is exactly what she attempts by analyzing Alexandra's narrative. She is unfair to Alexandra by making him a special case. Every biography, indeed every work of history, is open to another reading, another interpretation. The answer to a flawed biography, and every biography is flawed, is another biography, also flawed, but which corrects some of the errors in the previous biography. This is why Plath has had 5 biographers and will have more. When I wrote that sentence, I had no idea that the more would include me. Malcolm apparently believes there is no such thing as truth, and it is whole. But the other way to look at truth is to regard it as a slow, often interrupted, accumulation of knowledge, which is never whole at any point, but which is constantly growing and subject to revision. The great sin against knowledge and against biography that the Hugheses have committed is their effort to short-circuit this process because they feel wounded by it. Certainly they are injured by crude biographical speculation, but the Hugheses have led high-visibility lives. They have attracted precisely the kind of speculation they now want to squelch. Malcolm concedes this point when she explains that Ted Hughes authorized the publication of Plath's autobiographical novel, The Bell Jar, in order to buy a piece of property. This is hardly the action of a man interested only in preserving his privacy. He does not mind profiting from Plath's literary estate, yet he insists he is on high moral ground and that only the biographers are money grubbers. Malcolm suggests that Hughes's pecuniary motives were laced also with literary ones. That is, he had authorized the publication not only of The Bell Jar, but of Plath's journals with significant excisions because of their literary quality. Even when these works show him to disadvantage or at least raise questions about his behavior, he was willing to release them to the public because, Malcolm argues, he could not bear to suppress literature. Dubious argument, but I'll get to that in a bit. Malcolm may be right, but her argument is no more than ingenious speculation because Hughes never made a clear statement about his motivations. Indeed, he never granted an interview, never cooperated even with Anne Stevenson, the authorized biographer, except to respond to a few of her questions conveyed through his sister, Owen. If Malcolm is shrewd in pointing out the faults and ethical dilemmas of unauthorized biographers, she is curiously blind to the shortcomings of authorized biography. Her sympathies go out to Anne Stevenson, but Malcolm never fully acknowledges that the authorized biographer is just as likely to present a skewed version of the subject's life as the unauthorized biographer, because the authorized biographer is fatally compromised by giving up his or her independence. Malcolm even criticizes authorized biographers such as Bernard Crick, who insist on a written guarantee that George Orwell's widow would not interfere in any way with his collection and interpretation of the data. Malcolm finds Crick's position arrogant and unfeeling, and implies that a more cooperative attitude with the subject's widow and literary executors would yield a more intimate and humane biography. It might, but the biographer knows there are tremendous pressures to see things the subject's way, or the way of the subject's family. And Sonia Orwell was notorious for trying to skew the evidence to control the biographer. That's why Crick wanted that letter. Malcolm would be on stronger ground if she were to admit that neither biographers nor their subjects can occupy the high moral ground, and that the very process of writing biographies, whether they are authorized or not, is fraught with epistemological and ethical problems. She comes close to this position several times, but she keeps backing away from it, lured by her obvious romantic attachment to Ted Hughes, her Heathcliff, who has been done dirty by a legion of biographers. A more academic study of biography and literary criticism, which also uses Plath as a focus is Jacqueline Rose's The Haunting of Sylvia Plath. The literature on Plath shows how difficult it is to separate literary and biographical interpretation, especially since Plath used the living figures or images in her work, and those figures have copyright control over what they write and thus over what biographers and critics are allowed to reprint. To such living figures, literary analysis can have a personal significance unintended by the critic. Since Plath's representation of living figures is by its very nature incomplete, the efforts of critics and biographers to come to closure about her life and work cannot succeed. Rose demonstrates that the biographer or critic must maintain an open-ended and tentative approach to Plath's biography and art. I think that's right. Tentative. Provisional. Biographies are, if you want to call them an art, they're a provisional art. Well, after I wrote that review in 1994, I went on to do a revision of my Martha Gellhorn biography and a biography of Joe Craigie. That biography of Joe Craigie resulted in 9 trips to England to interview her husband, Michael Foot, and her other friends. It was an exhausting and an expensive procedure. And at that point, I wasn't sure that I would ever write another biography. We're now going, we're up to the year 2003, close to 10 years after I wrote that review of The Silent Woman. And I decided that it would be easier to stay home for a while and pontificate about biography and to reassess my own work. I came out with revisions of my biographies of Lillian Hellman and Norman Mailer and Rebecca West. And I also did a column for the newspaper New York Sun for 3 years, beginning in 2003. And I began reviewing for other newspapers, not just the New York Sun, but the Washington Post, Baltimore Sun, other online journals, University Bookman, also the New Criterion, a number of different publications. And I started collecting these reviews in self-published volumes, one called Reading Biography, which featured my reviews of different kinds of biographies of artists, politicians, and so on. Essays in Biography, which had an essay on Plutarch, which had an essay on how biographies are put together, had essays that were kind of like Plutarch's Parallel Lives, where I compared Rembrandt to other artists. Also a book called American Biography, Lives of the Novelists, and Female Icons, from Marilyn Monroe to Susan Sontag. All of these were collections of reviews and articles about biography. And I didn't get started on biography again until 2009, when I began work on a biography of Dana Andrews, the actor Dana Andrews. Two other books came out of this period of writing reviews, a weekly column, book review column for the New York Sun. Two books about biography. One was Biography, A User's Guide, in which you'll find that review of The Silent Woman. And A Higher Form of Cannibalism, published in 2005. A Higher Form of Cannibalism? That's a phrase taken from Rudyard Kipling. That was his characterization of biography, A Higher Form of Cannibalism. Book had a subtitle, Adventures in the Art and Politics of Biography. And in this book, one of my shorter books, I think one of the few books in which my sense of humor, I think, comes up. Not that I'm going to read you anything that's that amusing at this point, but I come back to Janet Malcolm, I'm reading from page 6 of A Higher Form of Cannibalism. I mentioned the London Observer's literary editor, Robert McCrum, who renewed Michiko Kakutani's offensive on biography, taking the novelist biographer Edmund White's remark for a column title, "Biography is the form by which little people take revenge on big people." McCrum invoked James Joyce's aversion to the biographine. I can't help also but thinking that there's another subtext to Janet Malcolm's Silent Woman, and that is, who are the people you respect? They're the poets, Ted Hughes, and Sylvia Plath, who's supposedly silent because she's dead, although Plath left so much in terms of diaries and journals and her novel and her poetry. It's hard really to think of her as the silent woman. I think it does her an injustice in a way. At any rate, who are these biographers in Plath's book? They're not poets. They're not novelists. They're second raters at best. They're biographers. In the literary ranking pecking order, biographers are way down below, certainly novelists, for example. Biographers, I'm reading now from A Higher Form of Cannibalism. Biographers empty or steal lives of their meaning, Janet Malcolm contends in The Silent Woman, her influential evisceration of biography. Like many critics of contemporary biography, Malcolm sides with the subjects, who were regarded as victims, and with their families, who must withstand the prying of biographers. She investigates Sylvia Plath's life in order to understand why it has occasioned so many biographies that tend to idealize her and demonize her husband. That is no longer so true, which again is kind of a rebuttal to Malcolm. If you look at some of the later biographies of Sylvia Plath, the idea that Plath is the idealized one and Hughes is the villain, certainly not true of Heather Clark's recent biography. And I don't think it's true of my book, American Isis, either, which was published in 2013. Malcolm investigates Sylvia Plath's life in order to understand why it has occasioned so many biographies that tend to idealize her and demonize her husband, Ted Hughes, a brilliant English poet. That's the point. He's brilliant. Not these biographers. And a ruggedly handsome man whom Malcolm believes biographers have maligned. And then I go on to, as I said in my earlier review, Malcolm calls biographers professional burglars, voyeurs, busybodies, and so on. Biographies raise the same sort of ethical concerns Malcolm has identified in her book, The Journalist and the Murderer, which I also mentioned in my review of Malcolm's book. And I mentioned the biographer, like the journalist, is driven by repertorial desire. So, in many ways, the book is a rehabilitation of Ted Hughes and even his sister, Olin. And I go on to say, as I said in the review, that Malcolm sees biography as an epistemologically problematic genre. I'm going to get back to how we know things and how confident we can be of knowing things, as I say in my next podcast. But I go on to say, in Adventures in the Art and Politics of Biography, past Malcolm, although I get back to her, in mentioning that the willful side of biography is apparent in Stephen Milhauser's, this is a novel, Edwin Mulhouse, The Life and Death of an American Writer, 1943-54. That's very funny, by Jeffrey Cartwright. You know, the writer dies at the age of 12. The curious thing is, you know, Sylvia Plath kept diaries beginning at the age of 12. You could write a kind of biography of her, even if she had died then. Anyway, Milhauser's novel is a send-up of biography, and the novel is divided into the early years, the middle years, the late years. I'm going to use that in my new book, The Making of Sylvia Plath. Even though she's 30 years old, I'm going to break down the same structure and show you how the early years and middle years are much more important than even a 1,000-page biography like Heather Clark's, let us know. It's a parody as well of Leon Adell's titles in his 5-volume biography of Henry James. Jeffrey Cartwright is Edwin Mulhouse's Boswell, not only faithfully recording the minutiae of the writer's life, but also creating situations in which he can observe his subject's life and eventually his death. Milhauser captures both the comic and sinister side of the biographer's devotion to the creative self, and the sense in which the subject is the biographer's creation, an extension of his desire to impose a certain order on sometimes trivial, sometimes hazy evidence. The very neatness of Jeffrey's mind calls into question his interpretations and the biographer's obsession to invent a unified self. I would add that that self isn't always unified, as I concede in my biography of Norma Mailer, which is the lives of Norma Mailer. I'm continuing to read from A Higher Form of Cannibalism. I once sat next to Stephen Milhauser during an event at the National Arts Club and tried to engage him in a discussion of his novel, but he was having none of it. Clearly, I was the enemy. I think I know why. Biographers, in his view, are bogus because they are writing fiction in the guise of nonfiction. For Malcolm, the biographer is also a suspect, a perp, as the police say. She raises all sorts of problems with the so-called data biographers collect. Interviews, for example, are done after the subject's death. I'm repeating some of the things I said in terms of her objections to a biography, that there is no infallible way to tell the truth. Well, what infallible way to tell the truth would there be? Well, stay tuned when I talk about the hermeneutic circle. I go on to talk about Malcolm's attack on Paul Alexander. Perhaps, you know, she says, Alexander relates the story as if it could be objectively told. My last paragraph here, page 9 of A Higher Form of Cannibalism. Perhaps Malcolm read Jean-Paul Sartre's novel Nausea. In his diary, Antoine Roquetin, the biographer of the Marquis de Rollebonne, grapples not only with the meaning of his subject's life, but with existence itself, concluding that he cannot finish his biography and cannot justify the meaning of another human being's existence any more than his own. The novel provides keen insights into the biographer's ambivalence about his subject and his sources, and into the way the biographer's life impinges on his subject, sometimes making the biographer feel he is writing a novel of another's life in compensation for the career he himself cannot pursue. And there is this, I wouldn't deny it, voyeuristic quality to biography. I'm certainly attracted to subjects. I mentioned the actor Dana Andrews. My early training and education was as an actor, and for all sorts of reasons, I didn't pursue it. It was going to be a hard life, I could see. And I was fascinated with someone like Dana Andrews, who spent a decade in Hollywood trying to get a contract before he was successful, and even longer than that before he became a star. That speaks to me. That speaks to my own experience and my wanting to understand that. Now, the last couple pages I want to read to you are from my 2013 biography of Sylvia Plath called American Isis, The Life and Art of Sylvia Plath. The thesis, and sometimes biographies have a thesis or an argument, they're not just one damn thing after another, is that Plath did create herself as a mythological figure, as an Isis. And I present the evidence in my biography. But the last chapter is about the mythology and the biography of Sylvia Plath. It's about the other Plath biographers up to that point and my analysis of them. And it's, in a sense, my reply and, in some cases, my rebuttal to Janet Malcolm. And in the title is in chapter, In the Temple of Isis. We're all in the Temple of Isis. That is, all of us, the biographers and those who read biography. I'll just read a few passages that relate to Janet Malcolm and this black art of biography. In 1991, about 3 years before Malcolm publishes her book, on 11 February, the anniversary of Sylvia Plath's suicide, Janet Malcolm met with Olin Hughes to discuss a projected book which became The Silent Woman. Like Judith Kroll, that's someone, a Plath critic who also met with the Hugheses, she was not a biographer, but she certainly is valuable to Plath biographers because of her eyewitness testimony as to how Ted Hughes and Sylvia Plath, Ted Hughes and Olin Hughes reacted to Sylvia Plath and how incompetent they were in taking care of her legacy. Like Judith Kroll, Malcolm describes Olin as forbidding and imposing, disdaining the plotting earnestness of biographers who pretend to be neutral or objective. Malcolm then dispatches Olin with gusto. Now I'm quoting Malcolm. She is like the principal of a school or the warden of a prison. Students or inmates come and go while she remains. Indeed, this is my voice, in Malcolm's film noir, Olin becomes Mrs. Danvers, welcoming Rebecca, the callow biographer, to Court Green, the Hughes home, the Manderley of Plath biography. One half expects Malcolm to include the Daphne du Maurier line, "Last night I dreamed I went to Manderley again." But Malcolm is rewarded only with Olin's grudging agreement to take the importunate writer for a look at the exterior of the Fitzroy Road flat. That's where Plath died, in London. Much of their conversation centers on how Olin had to nanny Anne Stevenson along to no avail. That, again, is the authorized biographer. Since Anne Stevenson got Sylvia, this is Olin speaking, got her wrong. Nothing can be done about it because Plath remains silent, powerful, and in the right. Malcolm characterizes Olin's demand that Anne remove an account of Sylvia's attack on Olin as the only available method of replying to Plath, even though Sylvia's harsh words can themselves be interpreted as a bias the reader is perfectly capable of detecting. You get that? Malcolm is even defending taking something out, because it puts Olin in a bad light. That Olin's only available method of replying to Plath is to take out what Plath said about her. Really? Olin, Malcolm implies, is unable to let the biographer and the reader do their work. In spite of Malcolm's criticism, Olin and her brother left Malcolm alone, perhaps because she had such obvious scorn for biographers who did not trouble to make the Hugheses into fully rounded human beings coping with an impossible situation, wishing both to protect their privacy and to do justice to Plath's work. Ted Hughes realized that Malcolm was on the estate's side, and I'm relying here on archival evidence at Emory University for this stuff. Ted Hughes realized that Malcolm was on the estate's side, because you won't learn this from Malcolm. And yet prior to publication, he still tried to ferret out what she would write about Olin. Malcolm replied on 16 September 1992 that of course Olin figured in the narrative, but she was not the central figure, Malcolm's words. The cagey, I call Malcolm a biographer here because in this instance, she's almost dealing the way biographers do with people they're interviewing and corresponding with. Malcolm added, "I feel by telling you this, I am saying more than I should. You may feel I'm saying too little." She's withholding. It's also a form of manipulation, the very thing Malcolm accuses biographers of Malcolm would say, well, of course, we're all these manipulators. That doesn't make my argument against biography. It doesn't destroy it. A brilliant stylist, Malcolm evokes the problematics of biographers. How can biographers possibly know the truth? As Dido Merwin said, they were not there. Of course, by this logic, Malcolm too is suspect, but presumably she is more honorable because at least she concedes, indeed wallows in, the fallibility of biography. But memoirs written after the fact are no less fallible, which is why Malcolm focuses on Hughes's letters, showcasing him as a brilliant interpreter of Plath's work. Malcolm is right to emphasize that in his letter, Ted expresses virtually no animus toward Plath. But it's hard to see why his later letters should be taken as the last word. In the end, Malcolm seems to have put herself in thrall to Ted Hughes, wishing, like Olwen, to safeguard him from predators. Ted Hughes, however, did not see matters this way. To him, and again, I'm relying on Hughes's own Emory archive in his letters, to Hughes, Malcolm had adopted the guise of an objective truth-teller. Uh-oh. Painfully and regretfully revealing the bad as well as the good because that's the truth. Those are Hughes's words. Her concoction of psychoanalytical commentary and self-doubt, this is Hughes's opinion, conveyed an impression of helpless verisimilitude. Malcolm knew her audience, this is Hughes again, and knew how it would eagerly devour a controversial book written with the patented Malcolm style. And Ted understood, as he warned Olwen, that she was the main target. By now, Ted was just part of, as he called himself, the trampled field. What does this all amount to? Well, part of what it amounts to is what I'm going to say in that next podcast, Biography in the Hermeneutic Circle. But what it means is we're all implicated. Malcolm knew this in one sense, and yet she couldn't help herself into making biographers the targets. That's the misleading part, I believe, of The Silent Woman. Thanks for listening. I'm in Charleston, West Virginia. It's a little odd thing to do. I'm on a train platform recording this podcast. I was going to do it on the train. We were behind a freight train that actually killed someone on the track, which is why I'm doing this and why you're hearing all these noises. I'm not going to say very much. It'll be a brief podcast. But I just wanted to say that, give you a little preview of coming attractions. I'm going to be talking in a forthcoming podcast about a polar explorer, Jackie Rahn, interviewing the biographer and also reviewing her book in the New York Sun. And also a biography of Warren Harding that's just come out. And it kind of builds on a biography of Warren Harding that John Dean, yes, that John Dean, wrote of Warren Harding, which was a kind of revisionist biography. This new biographer of Harding doesn't like that word revisionism because he thinks that's what historians have already done. They blackened Harding's reputation in what he calls revisionist biography. And what he proposes essentially is a restoration. He really calls this book a restorationist biography. I'm particularly interested in this book because the biographer is talking about how biographers, or in this case, historians, have shaped history. And he's a conservative, so he's looking at essentially a whole history of liberal historians who have discounted what the biographer feels are some of Harding's notable achievements. And yes, I think he did actually have some achievements. It's going to be a review that's going to take this biography seriously as biography. I'm expecting that a number of historians will attack this book, but I'm looking at it in a very particular way in which
He uses biography to re-examine the evidence. Well, this is a very short podcast. I'm going to have to check it to see if you can actually hear me with all the train sounds. So I bid you farewell from Charleston, West Virginia. Eventually, I will get home. But, you know, I'm in no hurry. I really don't care. Talk to you later. Thanks for listening.